Am I correct in assuming that Millennium is your baby? Tell me how the band came to be.
Millennium is my baby. Like, right now, while I'm doing this, I'm in New Orleans working on the Devil's Highway. That's a band, and it's more of a collective sort of thing. Millennium definitely is mostly my vision. Having said that, the Hourglass album, Jorn contributed a lot of the best ideas, and he and I had a great musical chemistry, and Shane wrote some great stuff on that too. So I would say it's more like I'm like the referee or the umpire. I have the vision for what I want it to be, and then I just like herd my chickens into the yard and make sure they all stay there. But you know, everybody else contributed a great amount, including Don Airey and Doug Stuckey from TNT, who unfortunately passed away from cancer, but he played some amazing keyboard parts on that too. And I just gave Don and Doug a general outline of how it should move the song forward and the sounds they should use and what I was thinking, but those things are all their ideas, not mine.
Hourglass was the third Millennium album, yet it was the first one without original singer J. Todd Plant. What were the reasons behind the move from Plant to Jorn Lande?
As soon as we finished Angel Fire, and I mean, I'm talking like 2 weeks after it came out, they got rave reviews, and that's a fucking great album, I think. And Todd kicked ass on it. Todd called me up, and he got an offer to sing with the Doobie Brothers. You know, and everyone has to eat and feed their kids and pay their mortgage and all that stuff. So I was like, all right, cool. And Todd is a fantastic person, like, in his heart. He is a good human being. But we clashed a lot, and he drove me and Shane a little bit crazy all the time. And so I was like, all right, we'll figure something out. So I called Mark Ashton, the guy that ran the label that at that time we were on, but it was coming out on Frontiers, but it went through Now and Then Records in England. And I said, dude, Todd's fixing to go sing with the Doobie Brothers. What are we going to do? And it was right when the album came out. Like, we couldn't do gigs or anything. And Mark goes, well, let me send you something from this Norwegian guy, Jorn Lande, and tell me what you think. So what he sent me was a Vagabond song, a thing that Jorn had done with Lonnie Letecro from TNT. And Lonnie Letecro is probably the most intelligent human being I've ever met. And he's a genius, like, musically and intellectually. He has so much, he's the most charismatic person I've ever met also. If he would have wanted to be, and I'm not exaggerating, like, the Prime Minister of Norway or anything like that, he could have done anything like that if that's what he wanted to do. He's an absolutely amazing and brilliant person. Anyway, but Mark sent me a couple tracks of Vagabond, and he sent me some stuff that Jorn did with the Snakes. So it's the White Snakes dudes without David Coverdale and with Jorn singing. And, you know, Jorn can do that style amazing. Like, it's weird because he's like one of the whitest dudes I've ever met, but he could give Aretha Franklin a run for her money when it comes to blues and soul. He's unreal. And I was like, yeah, that guy's great, whatever. And then he put me in touch with Jorn on the phone, and as soon as we talked, like, instantly, because I, you know, I'm a people person. I love other people. And I either bond with someone or I keep them at bay. And you know, within 30 seconds of talking to Yarn on the phone, I was like, I love this guy. And we just always got along. I mean, we butted heads about music sometimes for different reasons, which I'll talk about. But, like, as a person, I was like, yeah, that's the guy. So that's how, and then we talk, and he had listened to Angel Fire, and he's like, man, you remind me of Kansas, which I don't think it's anything like Kansas, but whatever, I love Kansas, though. So I sent him some of my ideas for the next album, and he sang some of his ideas to me over the phone. I was like, I love that. So then we brought him to Florida and started working on it. And a funny thing about that is that it was in October, and we were having an Indian summer, so it was like really hot and humid. I mean, like in the 90s and high humidity. And he's Norwegian. He literally outside was having trouble breathing because the air was so hot and thick. I was like, dude, what the fuck's wrong with you? And he's like, man, wait till you come to Oslo, and then you tell me. So then the next January, I was in Oslo to work at the TNT studio with him. And I came around, like, in the center, the Oslo Centrum thing. It's like this big, I don't know what you would call it. It's like a promenade or something. It's about a half a mile or a quarter or three quarters of a mile long, and it's ringed with, like, it's parks and skating rinks, and it's ringed with, you know, TGI Fridays and different things like that. And the parliament is on one end, and the castle of the king is on the other end. And I came down around the castle. It was in January, and the wind was blowing, and it was so cold that it literally hurt my teeth. So there is something to that thin blood, thick blood thing. Like, he can't take the heat, and I can't take the cold. So anyway, that's how we got Yorn.
Once Yorn was on board, how did the songwriting process change?
It was like this. Shane had some riffs that I wanted to make songs out of. I had some complete songs in my head. Yorn had a couple complete songs in his head. And so, aside from the complete songs in our head, Yorn and I would get together, sometimes just us, sometimes with the rest of the band, and we would play my musical ideas or Shane's musical ideas, and Yorn would just sing, come up with something to that. Hourglass was the first song that we wrote together, and it literally, his voice was so powerful, it kind of frightened me. Like, it was intimidating, and I'm like, God damn, that dude, I mean, it was so big and heavy and amazing. It's like, it really was a little bit intimidating. It freaked me out. And so Yarn and I would just go back and forth all the time. What about this? What about that? Like, we really inspired each other and had an incredible musical chemistry. And I hope that we will have that again someday. I definitely want to do something else with him. Pause for a second. You don't have to pause the recorder. I lost my train of thought, though, for a second. So don't, when you type this, don't type what I'm saying right now. We would go back and forth. Anyway, put it this way. We definitely, like, lit each other's brains up. Yorn and I did. I remember I was in Oslo at his apartment, the song Chasing Time. And I already had the music, and we had just been talking about it. And I remember it was nighttime, and we're just in his apartment, and he goes, deep in the night, there's an image on the ceiling. And he just sang that. And, oh, here's what I was going to tell you. Yorn has, okay, like, I know a lot of incredible musicians. like my good friend Per Nelson from Star Symmetry. He's one of the greatest guitarists in the world in any style. I know a lot of fucking brilliant artists and musicians. And I hope to be one of them someday. But Don Airey, who worked on that with us, is the greatest musician I've ever met by far. And like he, for instance, has conducted the Eurovision Finals Orchestra on live TV before a billion people watching it. He's that kind of musician. Jorn is completely intuitive. I'm kind of like in between those two things. But Jorn is so incredibly gifted. Like, he's full of music all the time. That one time, and I'm not making this up, we're in the band room, and I was fucking tuning my guitar, and Jorn's walking around biting his fingernails and chain smoking. He quit smoking a long time ago, but he used to chain smoke like I do. You know, super anxiety dude, all that stuff at that time. And I was tuning my guitar, and he was walking past me, biting his nails, and he hummed a melody to me tuning my guitar that was incredibly catchy. The guy is, you know, there's a difference between having a great voice and being a great singer and being a great musician. Those are three separate things. Jorn has obviously an incredible voice. He's an incredible singer, and he is also a fucking incredibly talented musician. He is full of music all the time. We clashed about certain things, but they were usually lyrical things because English isn't his first language, and it is my first language. Obviously, it's my only language. I speak a little bit of Spanish, but whatever. And I can curse in Japanese, but it was only things like that. And when we would have disagreements, not clashes, about things that had to do with music, like notes and chords and stuff like that, we always had this kind of communication and relationship. It was never about, you know, who's got the bigger dick. It was never like a mantra thing. It was like, what is the best thing for the song? And whether it was his idea or my idea, when we had a disagreement about something, we'd sit there and sing things to each other, you know, whatever. And when the right one came up, no matter whose idea it was, both of us would be like, yes, that. So it wasn't, you know, an ego clash. It was like, let, as Joe Perry said, let the music do the talking.
In your own words, share with us the experience of recording the Hourglass album. What were the studio sessions like, and where was the album recorded?
Excuse me. The drums were recorded at Morrisound in Tampa. The guitars and the bass was recorded at Morrisound also. The guitars, mine and Shane's guitars, were recorded at my house, at our band room, at Morrisound, and at the studio in Manchester, England. Don Airey's keyboard, and also at the TNT studio in Rafos, which you might as well just say Red Falls, because that's what it translates to, in Norway, like out in the country. Don's keyboards were done all at that studio in Manchester, which is a whole, we could write a novel about that experience. It was unbelievably amazing. And then Jorn's vocals were done at my house, at Morrisound, at that studio in Manchester, and at the TNT place out in the studio, out in the country. And the process, it was a long process, actually. But it was, like, really fascinating. Like, at the same time we were doing Hourglass, we were going to do that covers EP, and it had the bonus tracks, which we did. And Yarn was like, "Man, let's do Love Is Like Oxygen." I was like, "That's pretty fucking ambitious, dude." And like that one, I produced that. I basically produced that album, but like that's the best production I've ever done. So I remember, all right, Yarn, if we're going to do that, and that was when we were recording Don Airey's keyboards in England, which was, I mean, the dude is, it's hard to even explain. He's larger than life. He's such a brilliant man and an incredible musician. But anyway, I was like, all right, Yarn, if we're going to do Love Is Like Oxygen, we got to go get a copy of it. Let's check it out. You know, because I got to learn it, and it's a complicated piece of music. And so Yarn and I remember this so vividly, like it was yesterday. We're walking down the street in Manchester, and we stopped at some, like, what do you call it? Like a, you know, we got a hot dog on the side of the street or whatever. Then we stopped and got a beer. Then we went in this record store, and what we ended up getting was a sweet bootleg. And so it was like an 8-track or a 4-track demo of Love Is Like Oxygen. Unbelievable to hear like the ideas in that raw form. And I remember us then walking back to the studio, you know, and it was like it is here right now in New Orleans. It was cold and damp. And I'm like, fuck this, man, let's get back. I'm so cold. You know, and Yarn doesn't even have a jacket on because he's fucking Norwegian, so he's not cold at all. And then we listened to it, and I remember Don Airey, when we got back in the studio, Don was like, we listened to it, and he's like, oh, that's very clever. But he knew, he knows, you know, the keyboard player from Sweet. I mean, Don Airey probably knows Queen Elizabeth. He knows everybody. He told the stories about Ozzy and J.K. Lee and Randy Rhoads and John Sykes and, like, Gary Moore. I mean, he grew up with Gary Moore. He's like, so it's like being around him, you know, always, like, scared me a little bit. And he jumped on me a couple times because I was producing it and he was messing something up. And I was looking straight ahead and he was behind us with his keyboards on the thing in the studio. He was behind me. And I was just looking straight ahead, and I was afraid, I was too intimidated to tell him what he was doing wrong. He kept messing up, and finally he got mad. You know, and this is the guy that fucking played with Randy Rhoads and Michael Schenker and Lee John Moth. I'm like sitting there like, I cannot believe I am playing with this guy. And he got pissed off, and he's like, Ralph. He's like, yes, sir. He goes, is that your guitar in the corner over there? I said, yeah. He goes, did you write this? I said, yeah. He goes, go get your guitar and show me what I'm doing wrong. And I was like, holy fuck. I mean, it really, like, I was probably, like, having tremors. I was so nervous. It really freaked me out. So I got my guitar, and I said, here's what you're doing wrong. There's an extra half of a measure at the end of it every time, so when it turns around, it's not where you think it's going to be. And he goes, oh, you mean like this? It was on the hourglass. And I said, yeah. And I was so scared. And he goes, did you write that? Then I was like, fucking fuck, man. He's going to destroy my entire sense of, like, self-worth. And I said, yeah. He goes, oh, that's very clever. I was like, oh, kill her.
That's cool. When it comes to your solos, do you write them out beforehand? Do you just press the record button and wing it?
I do it a lot of different ways. Sometimes I figure out what I'm going to do beforehand and practice it and I'll write it out. Sometimes I'll do like 5 to 10 passes just completely winging it and either piece them together, the best parts. That's what David Gilmour does. He like does a bunch of solos, and then he takes a piece of paper, I read where he said this, and he goes through each section and he makes a tick on the paper, like, okay, that here, that there, that, and piece them together. I don't do that. I just go, I either let, if it's someone I trust, the engineer or producer do it, or I just listen to it, good, we gotta have that, we gotta have that, we gotta have that. But sometimes, you know, if I improvise it 8 times or whatever, one of them by itself just works. And then sometimes I do this, and this is the way I prefer, actually. It's a combination of improvisation and composition. Right then, while I'm recording it, I'll think of the first part, and then I'll record it. And then I'll think of the next part, and I'll record it. So it's, like, fresh, but it's also, like, compositionally, it has integrity, like, compositionally at the same time. And I do this, and this has irritated for years, because he started recording me when I was 12 years old. Just irritated Jim Morris a lot over the years, and it irritated a couple times, I think, Steve from Deicide, because he writes that music, and he, again, is a musical genius. I didn't realize it until I had to learn his music to play it. But I will only play something so many times in the studio, the instant that I feel, you know, it's like chewing a piece of gum until the sugar, all the sugar's gone. The instant that I start feeling like I can't, I'm thinking about it and I'm not playing with as much feeling, I stop, and I will not do it again, no matter who yells and screams or whatever. It has to have the feeling, and I don't care if there's mistakes there. I'm a sloppy guitarist. You know what I mean? I don't give a shit. I want the magic, not the precision.
What's your favorite memory from these sessions?
Hey, Susie, say that again? I'm sorry.
What's your favorite memory from these sessions?
There's so many that, I mean, it was such a magical time. It was so incredible. Susie, hold on. I got to take you in. I think I forgot to unlock the door, and David might be here.
Sure.
Hold on. I'm walking in here because I hear the dog barking. Hold on. Okay, I'm walking back outside. This giant Labrador that is the sweetest dog, but it barks when it hears something. Anyway, but there were so many incredible memories from that time, like really just special things. So I'll just tell you some of them. The first time that Shane went over to England to work on that, it was the first time that he had ever been out of the United States. And he had, like, lived... Excuse me, I got hiccups. Although I'm taking a drink. He had lived a really insular life at that point. So he was super homesick and depressed. And he was saying shit about England, like, literally, about, like, the ketchup is better. You know, I hate this ketchup. And I was getting irritated. I was like, well, why don't you just fucking stay in Zephyr Hills, dude? It's not about the ketchup. But then I realized that he was, like, suffering. We were standing, because Manchester's, like, a sort of industrial place, a lot of it. And Jorn, Shane, and me were standing on this train platform waiting for the train to come, to go wherever, I don't know where we're going, what we're doing. And it was so, the weather was terrible, and the place we're standing was so bleak, and just ugly, and, like, graffiti, and just nasty and industrial. And Jorn, I told you, was cynical. He was like, you know, since then, Shane has, like, played at Wacken and done all kinds of stuff, but this was the first time he'd ever been out of the country, you know. And Jorn was sitting there smoking cigarettes, I was too, and he's, like, saying to Shane, he's like, look at this, man. This is the real world. You live in this Disney World place, blah, blah, blah. And I could tell Shane was fucking about to cry. I mean, he's really homesick and depressed. And I fucking jumped all all over Jorn. It's like, man, what the fuck is your problem? You see how fat he is and you're doing that? You know, so we had that. One time at the TNT studio, it was like, okay, here's the backstory to that. It's at a house and a barn and a horse barn, which is really big, from like the 16th century. The fucking house and the one barn, the horse barn, are haunted as fuck. And the house has, like, downstairs, the rooms are different colors. So it's like the green room, the red room, whatever. The green room is super haunted. And one time, and I'll tell more about that house in a second, but because of that, and I'm sensitive to stuff like that, it was like, it was only me and Jorn there. And Jorn's like, man, I have to go to Oslo. And it's like 2 o'clock in the morning. And I'll be back in like 2 hours. I was like, dude, what the fuck? You can't leave me here in this fucking haunted house. You know? And like, you come out of the woods to the studio and there's these big dragon head things on the building like they'd be on a Viking ship. It's fucking trippy. He's like, no, everything will be fine. Well, I was scared as hell. I went out and sat outside, you know, and in the summer in Scandinavia, it doesn't ever get really nighttime. It's always just like twilight, which I love. I sat outside until Jorn came back because I was afraid to go in there. But at that place, the upstairs, the attic, that's like the private place that the clients aren't allowed to go to, where they just hang out and stuff. But Ronnie and Doc, you know, they totally welcomed me. Like, they were really kind to me. I brought them, well, that's another story I'll tell you in a second. But we hung out up there a lot, and like one of the windows in the attic, they had this big fucking like doll. It looked like a giant marionette and in the window, and it's creepy as hell. And but the first time that I went there, because this is what I used to do, I'd go the first couple times to Tampa on British Airways to London, and then London to Oslo. And then after like two times, I had an idea, and I called British Airways, and I said, hey, if I go to Oslo 24 hours later, is it the same price? And they're like, yeah, everything's fine. So then I started spending a day in London every time I go to Norway, and just by myself, and just fucking trip out and drink absinthe and just whatever. Go see things, the museums, you know, eat British food or Indian food, get drunk in my hotel, whatever. I would always have a day in London by myself. But anyway, but the first time I went there at the duty-free at Gatwick, I bought absinthe for them because I'd never met, you know, Ronnie the Tiger. He's a huge influence on me, too. He's like a hero to me. And so I got there, and it was late at night, and Jorn, me, Ronnie, Doc were upstairs in their attic, which is a really cool space, though. It sounds like rustic, but it's not. They've got it totally tricked out. It's cool. And I brought out this bottle of absinthe that I bought for them as a gift. And Ronnie LeTecro started fucking with me. And he's a very intimidating guy. I got pissed off. I was like, listen, man, I'll fucking come here. I'm spending all this money at your studio. I bring you this present. And you're, you know, treating me like talking down to me like this and stuff like that. And he fucking, like, nodded his head with a big grin on his face. And he goes, ah, I like you. He was testing me. If I would have let him walk all over me, he would have never liked me or respected me. He was seeing how I was as a person, and then from then on, he was incredibly kind and cool to me all the time. And I'll give you an example. one time about, say, 3 or 4 days before I was fixing to head over there, I was eating a cherry, and cigarette, and I cracked my teeth on it. So then I flew from Tampa to London. No problem. But for whatever reason, and it was a Sunday, when I flew from London to Oslo, I guess like the root or whatever of my tooth, the pressurization, so that it was so bad I was crying, and one of the stewardesses sat with me and held my hand. They gave me medicine. It was terrible. If I can get there, and the guard, I mean, like the airport in Oslo is really far from the studio, and I was in so much pain all of a sudden. Bjorn picks me up, we go to the studio. Ronnie had been, and this was before they had everybody was on the euro. This is when the different countries had their own currencies. And Ronnie was coming back that morning from Spain on holiday with his wife and his children. We're at the studio, and I'm just fucking, Ronnie walks in to the kitchen. That's the first room you walk in, that's the red room. And as soon as he fucking walked in, he saw me, and he pointed at me and looked at the other dudes, and he's like, what's wrong with this guy? And he knew me by then. And they're like, told him about my tooth and stuff. He fucking got on the phone, and he called this super high-tech dentist, and he basically said, it was in Norwegian, but I could understand enough, he said, you will go to your office and open it up and fix this guy right now. And he put me in his Volkswagen Rabbit, which was really cool, his car, and he drove me through the mountains to go to this high-tech dentist, and the dude gave me a root canal, which is the only time I ever had that, and it was so painful. And Ronnie sat there in a chair while the dentist was doing it, and I'm going, ah, and was laughing. He thought it was so funny. And then when the guy was done, Ronnie reached in his pocket, and he brought out a combination of British pounds, Norwegian kroner, and Spanish, I forget what the Spanish currency is called. I was going to say lira, but that's Italian. But all these different currencies, and it was more than what he owed the guy, and he just gave it to him and said, thank you. And he looked at me and said, get in the car. We left. He's an amazing character. The dude should be a reality show. But he was really kind to me, like, all the time, after he figured out that, you know, I was going to stand up. I wasn't going to let him walk all over me.
Do you have any nobody will ever believe this moments or memories from the Hourglass sessions? I think the one you just said is a good one.
That is a good one. I don't know. This isn't that, but here's a funny little anecdote. I told you that Don had his keyboard set up on a big rock behind us. Like, so there's the mixing board, then me, Yorn, and Ray, the engineer, and then behind us on the elevated thing is Don. And fucking, he's so brilliant. He would improvise music to what was going on. And he was so ingenious. It was so funny. Like, me and Yorn would be counting out change to see if we had enough to get a pack of cigarettes. And Don would be going, like, making it really tense and stuff. He did shit like that all the time when the record label guys would show up and say, what's going on? And be like, listen, dude, we're fucking doing what we're doing, and we have enough opinions here. I don't want any more. And Don would be like, with an orchestra. It was awesome.
When you guys weren't recording, how did you guys pass the time?
Just, you know, we just go to pubs and drink beers and stuff and just hang out. I mean, you know, Shane is like my little brother. I mean, we're incredibly close. And Yorn and I are very close too, and we would just sit around, and me and Yorn, not Shane, smoke cigarettes, and then we all just be drinking beers or drinking and eating and just talking and just being together. we didn't really need to, like, have, like, entertainment. We didn't need to go to movies or a strip club or something like that. We, like, were intellectually and, like, emotionally stimulated enough just being in each other's company, and we enjoyed it very, very much.
Were there any shows in support of Hourglass?
Say that again?
Were there any shows in support of Hourglass?
Yeah. We played, like, two in Florida, and then we did a tour in Spain. We did a couple in England, but we did a little tour in Spain also, opening up for my friend Vinny's band, 10. Vinny, like, anybody that knows me knows that I have a sense of humor, and my friends are funny as hell, too. But Vinny is by far the funniest person in my life, and he's an incredible guitar player. He's unreal. And we opened for his band, and Don was playing keyboards for his band. And we were on that tour, and it was so much fun. Like, I love being with Vinny, like, all the time. He's just the greatest. Just thinking about him makes me laugh. And I'll say this, but Sean, ask me before you put this in there, because I'm not sure if I want to say this publicly, but on, I think we actually did two of those tours, but on one flight on EasyJet from England to Madrid, Don Airey got up out of his chair. You know, he played with Randy Rhoads, Michael Schenker, Richie Blackmore, John Sykes, Willie John Roth, all my heroes at their peak. Because he's as good as they are. That's why. I mean, he's fucking, he is as good as Randy Rhoads was. He's as talented, he's brilliant. He got up out of his seat on the EasyJet plane, and me and Vinny, like, on that one tour, Shane had introduced me to vodka and Red Bull, like, energy drinks. I didn't know about that. So me and Vinny are sitting there, and the stewardess keeps coming by with her card, and she didn't even ask us anymore. She just gave me and Vinny, like, four vodkas each and, like, two cans of energy drink, and just kept going so we didn't keep hitting the button. And Don Airey got up out of his seat, and he came to me, and he goes, "Ralph, I want to tell you something." You know, and I'm totally intimidated by the guy. I kind of still am. I mean, he, like, when he was here with Deep Purple, me and my son and Jack from Deicide stood on the side of the stage, you know, and Ian Gillan gave me this really expensive bottle of wine and shit like that, but I'm still, Don Airey, there's, like, a wall there, like, I can never just be bros, like, I respect him too much, you know, there's, like, a thing there that I can't cross. I can't, he probably can, but I can't. And he got up out of his seat on the plane, just out of the blue. I'm sitting there drinking with Vinny, or the Viper, as we call him. And that's another funny story I was at. And Don came to me, and he goes, "Ralph, I want to tell you something." I'm like, "Fucking what?" I'm so scared. He goes, "Do you know why you have that thing in your heart for Randy and for Michael Schenker and for Gary Moore and for Uli John Roth?" And it totally freaked me out. I was like, I didn't know what he was going to say. It scared me. I was like, I was so nervous. I can feel it now. Because he's, like, leaning down, looking at me. And I said, "No, why?" And he goes, "Because you have the same gift that they have. You just don't realize it." And he turned around and fucking walked away and went back to his seat. And it fucking, it blew my mind. And that one thing right there, out of every tour I've ever done, playing every festival, anything I've ever done that has to do with music, that is the most valuable and important gift that I've ever, him telling me that means more to me than any of the other musical things that have ever happened to me in my life. But I'm not sure that I want to put that in the liner notes. So Sean, talk to me before you do that.
Prior to 2004's Jericho, Jorn made his exit. The Hourglass lineup seemed like a match made in heaven. What happened, and what led to Plant rejoining the band?
Jorn just started doing his own thing. Like I said, there's no bad thing between us or anything. And I was, like, learning the Ice Dirt set, and just, like, we just, our paths, like, diverged, but no bad blood, no drama, nothing like that. But then I had these other ideas, and it wasn't possible at that time to do them with Jorn, so I got Todd back to do them. The problem was, Jorn is able to sing in any range, like from down here, how he talks, to like soprano, and he sings it with his real voice, not falsetto. He can sing anything with equal power and conviction. There's not many people that are able to do that, but I wrote this song on Jericho with Jorn's voice in my head. And then when I went to use Todd instead, Todd sings absolutely incredible in the tenor range. But anything lower, especially lower than that, and a little bit higher than that, it doesn't, and that's just the way people's bodies are built. It's their vocal cords, you know. Like Tony Harnell sings that incredibly high stuff, full voice. He's a smaller person, so his vocal cords are, you know, consequentially, like, shorter. It's just a thing about people's physicality. And so I wrote this song with Jorn's voice in mind, and then when I had to use someone else that wasn't him, then it didn't work as well.
Looking back on Hourglass, what are your personal highlights on the album, and what are your favorite tracks and why?
My favorite song on that is Hourglass. That's the first one we did with Jorn. You know, wrote it in the band room in Tampa. His vocals on that, I think, are like one of the best, if not the best thing he has ever done. It's magical. The stuff that Don Airey played on keyboards is just, again, magical. And like at the end, you know, because I would tell people I want this, but I would just make an outline, you know, like paint my numbers and let them color it in. So I told Don, like, one of the things I said to him was at the end part, where it goes, I said, Don, just do something here at the end that has forward motion. So he played that, and just off the top of his head, he's such a genius. Me and Shane, since then, I mean, we still do it for years. We're like, all right, this part right here, that's where the mechanical dragons come out. And I do this thing, you can't, you know, really type this out, but with my hands and like a little, like, mechanical dragon dance where I come out, and then I turn to the audience and go, like with the flame, and then I go backwards doing the same little dance, and it fits so perfect with that music. Me and Shane have been milking that for years, but that's my favorite track on there. But there's a lot of things, like, you know, the song Rocket Ride. That was the first time Jorn, I told you that there were songs that I had in my head finished, and Jorn did too. That was the first time Jorn came to Tampa, and me and him were down in Ybor City, and that's like the Bourbon Street of Tampa. We're fucking drunk and smoking cigarettes, and we're walking down the sidewalk, like with our arms around each other, just talking. He goes, Mud, here's this song. Do you think we can use it? And he goes, Wendy comes to me to eat. He had the whole melody and stuff and the lyrics already done. I did the music to it from what he had for the vocals, you know, and I remember that because it just was another, like, signal to me. This guy's a fucking genius. He's just full of music. Like the Chasing Time. He started seeing those when I was in Norway, and that was the first time I'd ever been to Norway, and I was in his apartment, and I was like, that's just, he just sat up off the couch and stood up and goes, hey, how about this? Deep in the night, there's an image in the sea there. He's so brilliant. And like, me and Jorn were sitting in my car in the parking lot of Morrison. We were talking about Superstar, and that song is actually about Jesus Christ. And I was like, because we were about to go in there and start working and stuff, I was like, you know, I'm thinking the second verse, these words, love that you never can find again, or you never thought you'd find again, but that was then, and now everything's clear, no mistake at all, whatever. And I said, and I kind of hummed the melody, and I said, but I want it to be kind of Foreigner-like. And Jorn, fucking right there in my car, he goes, yeah! And you know what I'm saying? I was like, fucking hell. And that's another thing. When we were in my car, that first time he came there, and it was hot as balls in Florida, and we're talking about the cover thing, because we'd already decided we're going to do that after the album, and he suggested Jane by Jefferson Starship. And I was like, and this is when I first met him. So I didn't, you know, I wasn't aware of, like, his, like, how, what's the peak of what he can do pitch-wise, things like that. And I was like, you want to do Jane? I love that song, but can you sing that thing, you're playing a game before the solo where he goes real high? And he's fucking in my car, the windows are up, he goes, you're playing a game, and he hit that, and it was so loud with the windows closed, it hurt my ears, and it was 10 times more powerful than Mickey Thomas did it on the original. And I'll tell you one more thing. I play on stage loud as fuck. And when we did this one gig in England at this festival, when we were done, like the last things, we're going, you know, whatever. And I'm loud as hell. And we're going through a big PA. Jorn pulled the mic like 2 feet away from his face and sang a note so loud that the people said when he did that, you couldn't hear any of the band. You could only hear him. His voice is unbelievably powerful.
Looking at the selection of cover songs, how were they chosen? What was the criteria for picking covers to record?
Well, Jorn had the idea to do Love Is Like Oxygen, which I was skeptical about, but it turned out to be great, and I think that's the best production, you know, that I've ever, that's my best shot at producing something so far, because it came out great. And Jorn had the idea for Jane, and then I had the idea for On and On by Michael Schenker Group, and then I don't know if it was he or I that had the idea for I Surrender, because we both loved that album by Rainbow, but then that was the other one. And then one thing, and I think, honestly, I think Jorn sings it better than Joe Lynn Turner did, and if you didn't hear me playing guitar, you would almost think it was Rainbow, except Jorn's voice is just a little bit heavier, and Don Airey played on that with us, and he played on the Rainbow bird. That's him on the Rainbow thing. And I remember we're in the studio, and there's this incredible run that Don does at the end. And I asked him, I was like, hey, dude. And he did it on our version, the same one he did with Rainbow. And I was like, hey, dude, can you do that slow so I can learn on my guitar? And he goes, no. Do your work. Sit there and listen to it and pick it out by ear like everyone used to have to do. And he wouldn't show me how to play. And I was like, I was kind of intimidated, but inside I was a little bit like, oh, that's funny. Susan, I need to go in and pee. Can you hold on for a second?
Yeah, of course.
I'll be right back. Okay. I don't want to take the facts, but I want to make it there.
Sean, we're just taking a little break for a second.
Hey, sorry about that.
Hello. You've just got two more questions to go.
Okay. I know I'm giving long answers, but that's what I think he wants.
Yeah, it's fantastic, though. You ready?
Yeah.
Okay. In previous interviews, you've said that Millennium's output is geared more towards Europe and Asia. Was that an objective from the onset, or were those just the markets that really got it and responded the most enthusiastically?
This is really one that I have to, like, look at in hindsight. It's more that that's who would respond to the stuff more, because, like, I just do the music that I want to do, and I hope people like it, but I never, like, you know, whatever's in my mind at that time, you know, and whatever feeling I have, like, in my spirit or whatever in my life at that time, then that's what the music is. And, you know, I hope people like it, but they can like it or not like it, fuck it. I mean, that's what, you know, like, okay, for instance, I'll try and explain this so people can understand. My friend Bill, that plays in Trans-Siberian Orchestra, he is also my little brother. I love him dearly. He is about his career. And, I mean, this isn't, I'm not ripping on him. We talk about this all the time. He won't disagree with anything. He wouldn't disagree with anything I'm about to say. He's all about his career. I am all about trying to be the best artist that I can be. And, like, when I die, it's more important to me that I did the most and the best art that I could do with the gift God gave me than how famous I was. So I just do what I do and let the chips fall where they may. It just happens to be that European bands seem to be more open, you know, to what you want to do. Like, you know, like, if Aerosmith came out with Toys in the Attic now as a new band, it's one of the greatest albums of all time, they couldn't even get a record deal. But people in Europe would like it. They're open to artistic expression. And the Japanese love that melodic rock stuff. And, you know, because they have a thing about Western culture in general that they just have appropriated it and made it their own Asian version of it. But, you know, like, I bet Journey gets bigger guarantees in Tokyo than they do in Los Angeles. And that's the only way I know how to explain it. But I don't think about, are people going to like this? Are people going to like that? I just do what I do, whatever, like, that inner thing in me tells me to do musically. I just do it and fuck it.
The second part of that question is, how is it different from the U.S.? But I think you sort of answered that within that question.
Well, okay. But I'll give another answer. I'll finish that. Like, here, people, say young people, whatever's trendy and is on the radio, that's your thing. And then, people older, like from like 30 to my age, then it's only what they grew up on that they think is cool. You know, just people seem to be more set in their genre-specific mind frames here than they are in certain other parts of the world.
Some of the material on Hourglass feels a little more polished than Millennium's prior work. The keyboards and the vocal harmonies are slightly more prominent. The hooks are equally catchy, but often in a manner that, but often in a manner that might have a certain wider appeal, etc. You've often stated that your songwriting is just what it is, that you just roll with what comes out of it at the time. Was that the case here?
It is, although I think that Angel Flyer is a lot more polished than Hourglass. But, like, one of the first questions you asked me is Millennium my baby? It is. Angel Flyer is about 75% my vision. Hourglass, because of Jorn, especially because of Jorn Bashan too, is a little bit more like spread out as far as whose ideas and whose visions, you know, are going to be used. And like I said, I'm like the umpire, and I'm about to do another Millennium album. You know, I just kind of keep my chickens in the yard, you know, and keep going towards this point that we want to go to, but everybody can put in whatever they want to put in, and as long as that's not a chicken that doesn't belong in the yard, then we use it. It's different. Jorn, mostly on that album, not completely, but mostly, the vocal harmonies are what Jorn wanted to sing, you know, with his things. On Angel Fire, I do... it's hard to explain if you're not a musician, but I do chordal harmonies. Like, in other words, when Iron Maiden do those guitar harmonies, they're linear, so it's just, they just go a third above and stuff like that. I do chordal harmonies more like when someone plays on a piano. So sometimes, you know, when one note changes, the other guy will keep singing the same note like that. So that's the way I do vocal harmonies. That's the way I do guitar harmonies too, actually. And because that's the way I think of things. It's vertical rather than linear. But on Hourglass, you know, if Jorn goes, "Mom, I want to sing this," and he does it, like, "Yeah, that's cool. Do it. Whatever." I mean, you know, as far as keeping your chickens in the yard, when you have someone that is that much of a fireball of brilliance and skill, you know, unless it's something that really fucking bothers me, then I'm like, I was like, just do what you want, dude. I mean, I totally enjoyed the process of creating and then recording him. It was inspiring to me to just let him express himself and stuff. He's better than people actually even think he is. His own fans don't realize how great he actually is.
Okay, that was the last question. Is there anything else you want to say?
No, but I was going to ask you this, Susie, and if you don't want to do this, it's totally cool. I appreciate you just did this for me.
Sure.
But could you, and believe me, it'll take about a third as long as this did. Would you be willing to do the same thing with the same questions with Shane? Because I want his input.
Sure. Now say it again. What do you want?
Would you be willing to do what you just did with me?
With Shane. Oh,
because I want his input. And I'm going to talk to Christine and see if Jorn will do it too. He's a pain in the ass, though.
Yeah, I
mean,
totally
he really is a pain in the ass. I love him, but I'll put you and Shane together on Facebook. I already asked him if I could give you his phone number and stuff, because I told him, I was like, dude, you need to, you know, that was a big thing in your life too, and, you know, you need to put your 2 cents in, and this lady, you know, is really easy to talk to, and he's like, yeah, sure. So I'll put you all together on Facebook, and you guys can work out the details, but I'd really appreciate that.
Sure, and you'll talk to Sean and tell him what you're doing? Sean,
pardon me?
Sean Pallotta, you'll let him know that you're doing it with the other people?
Yeah,
too?
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm still,
yes, ma'am.
I'm still recording. What I'm going to do, I just want to confirm, I'm going to email this file off to Sean, and I'll save it on my desktop until I can confirm he's got it.
Fantabulous.
Okay, and you're going to talk to him about that Don Airy question that you want confirmation that you want
to
put it in?
Yeah, he'll have to talk to me because I'm not sure I want to, because that sounds like name dropping, and also it's embarrassing to me that that person who is that legendary told me that I'm like Michael Schenker or Randy Rhoads.
No, you know,
I mean, it's uncomfortable.
Ralph, I thought it was one of the coolest things on the interview. I'm going to stop recording now real quick.